The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now.
Hello and welcome to you all. This is another live Clubland Q&A from Stein Online's Northern headquarters. This is the Great White Takeover, not in a, white replacement, white supremacist, neo-Nazi kind of way. No, I mean the Great White North of Canada, although a little less so in June. But nevertheless, this is Mark's Canadian compatriot, Andrew Lawton, filling in as Mark basks in the glory of his triumphant stand for free speech in the United Kingdom yesterday. I suspect we will talk a fair bit about Stein v. Ofcom, but as I mentioned in the little text that accompanied the announcement that I'd be doing this, you can also go with United States v. Hunter Biden, Justin Trudeau v. Pierre Poilievre, the global elites v. everyone. You've got lots of conflict and lots of tension, but keeping with the formalities of the Stein Online Clubland Q&A, I'd be remiss to not point out that where I am in lovely Ontario, Canada, it is just after 3 o'clock Eastern time, but it is 9 a.m. Wednesday morning in Honolulu, a more midday 11 a.m. in Anchorage. It is noon hour in Vancouver, Phoenix, Los Angeles, the fecally saturated San Francisco, and also, I believe, in Las Vegas. It is 2:03 in the afternoon in Lima, the same time in Chicago and Minneapolis, and I believe in Milwaukee, where the Republican convention is soon going to be taking place. It is, what time is it? 4 o'clock in Sao Paulo, 8 o'clock in London, where the famous court battle just took place yesterday, making it a little after 9 o'clock in much of Central Europe, including in Belgrade, 10 o'clock in Tallinn and Addis Ababa, leading us all the way to Karachi, where it is just a few minutes into Thursday morning. 12:30 in Mumbai and Kolkata. So if you like the 30-minute time zones, you can do that. And if you really want to go wild with the 45-minute time zones, it is 12:48 a.m. in Kathmandu. So we'll end it there. Suffice it to say, it is wherever you are around the world, hopefully a great day, morning, evening, or night for you. As mentioned, I am Andrew Lawton. I have been Mark's unlicensed barrister in past cases, although I didn't exactly pass the threshold to qualify as in his unlicensed barrister in Stein v. Ofcom. Now, that's not actually the name of the case. It's I forget the citation, but it's like the king. It's basically, as Mark says, he gets second billing to King Charles III. But I want to just start off by talking about this case. Now, I should give you just as a little technical note here. We are forging ahead with this show, but normally there are like at least two people involved in making the show happen. I focus on, when I'm guest hosting, the microphone and the levels and, making sure that I'm going on and off and all that. And then there's someone else behind the scenes who approves the comments so that the questions that I'm being asked in the Clubland Q&A scroll across my screen and I can, focus on all of my attention on just answering them. For whatever reason, our designated question approver today is locked out of the website that we use for the questions. So I'm going to be like adding another task to the list here. And if I'm scrambling at a couple of points in the show because I'm, trying to find what tab I'm on and approve your questions, that's why. But we've pre-approved a few. And again, when I say approved, I just mean like check the box so it appears on the website. We're not, Klaus Schwab isn't vetting your questions to make sure they are compliant with the World Economic Forum plans. But I think actually I made him Spanish on the penultimate syllable there. But Anyway, it is great to be with you. And the big fight, I was reading Naomi Wolf, who is an interested witness in all of this, because it was her comments that Ofcom found so offensive on the second offending episode. She was in London, and she was tweeting up a storm as all this was going on. And what was fascinating in what Naomi Wolf had to say about this, and I was reading some of her thoughts before we get on here, is that she listed volumes and volumes and volumes in her statement of data on which she relied to make the claims that she said were supported by facts. This wasn't just an opinion. She said the vaccine harms were supported by facts. Now, she does not claim to be a medical doctor. She says she's a journalist. She has reviewed the facts. She's talked to people that have looked at the facts. She has not, she's not been a scientist in all of this. But she went where the facts led her. And whether you disagree with that or not, there's no denying that she provided voluminous amounts of evidence on which she relied, as did Mark in the course of his show. And if you took issue with that, you could have debated it, as Jamie Jenkins, the Mark Stein Show's resident stat man, did. And what did Mark do? Bring him on the show to have the discussion, because that is what, in a free society, you are supposed to do when you have disagreements. As we've learned in the course of Mark's trial with Michael Mann, which seems like a distant memory now, facts can be subject to multiple interpretations. And I'm not being a relativist about it. I'm not saying that, oh, well, you know, there are multiple right answers, but there can be right answers and wrong answers. And you only get to the bottom of those by being able to freely and openly discuss them and interrogate them and challenge assumptions, challenge premises. And the debate here was not even about vaccination. The debate is about officialdom. And should the government, which by its own admission on a number of occasions has gotten facts wrong about COVID, should they and their data in one particular instant be above criticism and above critique? Ofcom says yes. Stein and Wolf and anyone who values freedom of speech is saying no. And what I found so shocking here, there was a moment in this. Now, I wasn't able to be in, and of course, this wasn't live streamed because courts are among the most closed institutions in the Western world. The United Kingdom is terrible for this. Canada is terrible. The US is a little bit better, but it truly does depend. The thing that I found so fascinating is that, and I'm quoting from what Naomi Wolf wrote here and what I saw someone reference on Twitter. She took issue with Ofcom designating her a conspiracy theorist, but they also said the following: conspiracy theories can be true. Conspiracy theories can be true. That is what Ofcom has argued in court. And when this came up yesterday, apparently there was a fair bit of laughter, so much so that Mrs. Justice Farby warned people if they could not contain themselves, she would clear the room. But just think about that for a moment. Conspiracy theories can be true, but that doesn't mean they're not conspiracy theories, and thus that they aren't guilty of wrongthink as designated by the state commissars. I am a Canadian, so this reminded me of a Supreme Court ruling that came about human rights regulations and speech restrictions some years back. It's called the Whatcott case, and Mark has referenced that on a couple of occasions. And it said that just because a statement is true doesn't mean it can't also be harmful and illegal. So the reality is, and this is what was put on full display evidently in the Ofcom hearing yesterday, is that truth is no defense. So even if you do stand on the truth of your comments, which Mark does, which Naomi Wolf does, if you stand on the truth of your comments, that doesn't protect you against being maligned by the state as a conspiracy theorist. You can have the right opinion that is factually correct, but if it is the wrong opinion in the eyes of the censors, your facts don't matter. Truth does not matter. And I was actually grateful they were as transparent about that as they were. I was grateful they owned up to that as much as they did. Because they're basically telling you that this is not about right or wrong. They should be encouraged to find stats. They should be encouraged to have debate. It is not about that at all. What it is about is them wanting to decide unilaterally what the correct position is and what the incorrect position is. And you may recall, Mark has played this clip on the show in the past, and I know we don't normally do clips on the Q&A because it's supposed to be your questions that govern the flow of the show, but I hope you'll give me a guest host indulgence here because I pulled one clip. This was from, I believe, January of 2023 when I was in the Davos, I was in Swiss Alps, with the World Economic Forum. I wasn't there with them, but I was there for them. I was reporting on their big annual meeting in the mountains, and I was trying to hunt down all these elites, ask them a variety of questions, and the way it works is quite something because you don't necessarily know who's walking around, so you've got to just see if you recognize any faces, and then you got to squint at their name tags and see if you recognize that, and then if you do, you have to instantly come up with a line of questioning in a few seconds before they're gone and chase after them. Now, this was quite easy when I saw someone who I didn't know would be in Davos, Melanie Dawes, Dame Melanie Dawes, the chief executive of Ofcom. At the time, they had not yet found against GB News. They had not yet found against the Mark Steyn Show, but they had decided to investigate for the very thing that they would later convict Mark and the Mark Steyn Show of. And I decided to ask her about that, despite her proclamations that Ofcom and she support free speech.
I was just wondering if I could ask you about whether you think Ofcom is being fair in enforcing its COVID misinformation policy against very legitimate discourse about COVID.
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean, to be honest.
Well, people that have spoken about vaccine injuries have received Ofcom complaints and investigations, and broadcast licenses are in jeopardy of people that talk about very real issues.
I just don't think that we've... I'm not sure. It's very hard to answer that question without a specific instance, but...
GB News is facing investigations.
Well, there are sometimes cases where we open up an investigation, but, you know, let's see how that goes. What we're absolutely clear about is that freedom of expression is incredibly important in our... the way that we deal with the broadcasting code, so people are absolutely entitled to express views. So we always abide by those principles whenever we're looking into anything.
So do you believe that discussing vaccine injury should be allowed?
Certainly, absolutely. Free and frank and open conversations are always good on any topic.
Free and frank and open conversations are always good on any topic. Now, at first it was, oh, whoa, whoa, what, who, where, what discussion? No, investigating COVID discussions and in this establishment, gambling here, what here? No. And then all of a sudden you give her a little prompt and she, okay, yes, well, you know, I know, and we investigate and, oh, let's just see what comes of it. Who knows? Maybe it'll be something and maybe it'll be nothing. And then eventually she comes out with the kicker there, which I agreed with. Free and fair and frank and open discussion are always good. Well, Ofcom was evidently not prepared to hold up its end of that bargain there, as we're seeing. And whether the UK courts will, for their part, hold up free speech, I have become increasingly pessimistic in a Canadian context. We don't have a First Amendment in Canada, and even less so in the United Kingdom. But sometimes a miracle happens, and by the accounts of several people who were there, there were actually some, it seemed like the judge was fair, certainly better than some of the judges you see in the United States. By the way, I know it's normally about questions, but if you happen to be someone who was in the courtroom for the great standoff against Ofcom, and you've got your own thoughts to share, feel free to pipe those in the comment section. We'll try to share some of those as we go here. We'll break with the usual format in that sense. I mean, try to have like a question mark in there somewhere. That's all I can ask of you. But Chris Davies writes, Andrew, good to have you back in the hot seat. We keep hearing rumors on this side of the pond that Justin Trudeau is on the verge of resigning. He'll probably make a fool of me now and do it, but I think there's not a remote chance of it happening. What's your take, please? Keep well. Now, Chris, actually, I should give honorable mention. I saw on Twitter, he, or X as we call it now, that he hosted a reception in Mark's honor last night after court, which I'm sure was very much appreciated. The photos looked like it was just a bang-up good time there. So here's the thing. This is the perennial question. Well, I guess not perennial. It's the daily question in Canadian politics now. And my position has kind of been in alignment with yours there, Chris, which is that Justin Trudeau wants to, he doesn't care if the whole thing burns into ashes behind him. He doesn't care if the ship sinks. If he's sinking, he wants the ship to go down with it. And I'm mixing my metaphors there, but I think there's a reason for it, because Trudeau really doesn't care about any legacy other than his own. And he's made this clear because his party right now is absolutely set to be trounced in the polls. If the election were held today, it would be an absolute blowout with a massive, massive conservative majority, perhaps an unprecedented one for the conservatives led by Pierre Poilievre in Canada. But Trudeau would have brought his party from a majority government to a minority government to an absolute obliteration. And that is not something that will be easily changed. It won't be changed at all if he's the guy at the helm of the party. So I think there's one exception to this. Well, I think he's going to be fine with burning it down behind him because that's always been his position. He says, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to run. I'm going to stay prime minister. I'm going to be the guy on the ballot in the next election. There is coming up in, I think it's 12 days, I think it's the June 24th, what's called a by-election, which Brits will be familiar with. Americans think of it like a special election, so to fill a vacancy in one seat. Now, this is a seat that has always been, well, not always, but generally been a Liberal stronghold. It's one of the safest Liberal seats in the country. The candidate for the Conservatives there in a given election is a sacrificial lamb who usually does it just to show the party that they are committed. And the reality is the polls are showing that this is going to be a close race. I think the Conservatives are going to lose. I think the Liberals are still going to win, but this is something they should be winning by thousands and thousands and thousands of votes and may only win by a percentage or two. And if that happens, Justin Trudeau will have a revolt from his party on his hands when, you know, it looks like, all of these people that are in ridings that are much closer realize they're going to lose. And the only person they can really blame right now is Justin Trudeau. But the reality is they don't actually have, that party does not have a mechanism by which people can get rid of Justin Trudeau before the election. You know, the Conservatives have an ability where Conservative members of Parliament, the party's caucus, can actually vote and get rid of him. They did that with the last guy, and this is what brought us Pierre Poilievre. The Liberals don't have that. So the Liberals are not. Liberal members don't have a voice. Liberal caucus members don't have a voice. The only people that really have a say in this are, well, Justin Trudeau. That's it. The only guy. Sure, there can be public momentum. His party could sign a petition. They could start publicly calling for him to leave. But they can't actually get rid of him. And, you know, I realize when I say this, I'm kind of making it out as though Liberal members of Parliament are victims in a way. And I don't think that's, well, it's not entirely untrue, but it's also at the same time not entirely true as well, because they've endorsed and upheld this government time and time again. And at various points when I think the situation warranted a bit of a backbone. For example, when Justin Trudeau started freezing the bank accounts of his political dissidents, used unprecedented wartime legislation called the Emergencies Act to freeze his critics' bank accounts, to crack down on a peaceful protest. That was a situation in which perhaps some Liberal member of Parliament could have sacrificed their ambition and been honest, but it never happened. There was even more recently a gentleman by the name of Anthony Housefather, who you may recall if you followed when Mark testified a couple of years back before the House of Commons on free speech. Anthony Housefather was the chair of the committee. Anthony Housefather, very, very passionate Jewish man, represents Jewish constituents, very perturbed by anti-Semitism, very supportive of Israel. He has been alone in his party, which has been increasingly kowtowing to Hamas apologists. And he almost left his party. He almost quit the Liberal caucus over this, but he took some time, reflected, and came back and said, oh, absolutely, the Liberals are my home. I'm going to stay here, and I'm going to work from within. And now he's out there campaigning for the Liberals as though there was no harm done. So here's a man again who put his political career over his principles. So if the Liberal caucus believes that Justin Trudeau is harming their political future, harming their political careers, they have only themselves to blame because they have upheld this government time and time again. So that's a lengthy way of saying that, Yes, he should resign because it's just not going to work out too well for him, Chris, but I don't think he's going to, and no one in his party has really come up yet with a backbone to openly call for him to leave. It's just been this little quiet mumbling and murmuring behind the scenes, which has only furthered it. But as it stands, election scheduled for October 2025. It could theoretically be earlier, but there's no incentive for the Liberals to have an early election when they're going to be trounced as much as they are. John Frey asks, have you ever worn one of the white wigs like those in Commonwealth courtrooms? Can you describe how it feels? Are they really dusted with white powder? Are there loners if one barrister forgot theirs? How are they cleaned between you? This is a hyper-specific question. How are they cleaned between uses? So my knowledge of this is somewhat limited. Now, when I've been in London, if you walk down the Strand, which is it turns into Fleet Street, there's this barrister's outfitting store, and they have the robes and the wigs, and they're for sale, and they're very expensive because the real robes and the real wigs are made with a lot of care, and they're made with a very high cost, I was going to say ingredients, but materials. I believe the barrister, someone will correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the barrister wigs are all still horsehair in some way. They have vegan ones as well. I just looked it up. They have vegan wigs, so I don't know if the vegan wigs are cheaper or more expensive, but they're made of horsehair, and I wore one once. It wasn't a proper one, because if you watch the Mark Steyn Christmas show in 2019, this is the one that featured Orson Bean and Tal Bachman and Carol Welsman and Anthony Kearns and Mark Steyn. I got to play a small role in it as one of Mark's barristers. Actually, no, I was Marla Schaffel's barrister, I believe. And I had to wear a wig for that. I don't believe it was a real one. And I don't actually know what it was made out of. And I think it's now sitting, like, you know, collecting dust in Mark's office or something. So that was not a case where I could give you a full accounting of whether it was comfortable or not, except it had like a nice little under padding. It wasn't uncomfortable. Might have been a bit itchy if I had had to do it for a while. But no, I don't actually know if they have loaners available. I would assume not. I mean, if they're, these things are as expensive and prized as they are, you'd think that they would be, you just wouldn't dare forget it at home. However, in the American context, barristers are separate from solicitors. So I would assume that, like, the barrister with their limited workload, because they're not doing solicitor stuff, could just remember to never forget the wig. So maybe they just, you know, keep it in the trunk of their car just in case. But it's a good fun question there. All right, we've done Canada, we've done the UK, we've got a US question here. Bill Bradshaw writes, Andrew, Joe Biden is a good debater. He has good command of facts and figures, but even better, he can lie with such ease and composure, many people can't tell he's lying. Remember 2012 when he made Paul Ryan look like a deer in the headlights. Trump needs to have facts at hand to rebut Biden's lies. And like what Mark says about how the number of mail-in ballots skyrocketed and all the indicators to win an election all pointed to Trump and Biden wins. Trump needs to do well to get his momentum going. Thanks, Bill Bradshaw. I kind of reject the premise that Joe Biden is a good debater. I think he was in his prime, and his prime was, you know, 74 years ago or something. I think every single week now, there is some video clip of Joe Biden just not knowing where he is or not knowing what he's saying or not knowing what he, like, just every week now. It's gotten to the point where it's more newsworthy if Biden manages to get through a public event without attracting some sort of negative attention. So I don't actually buy the idea that he's going to be the Biden of 2012. And I mean, even the Biden of 2020 is, I think, a far cry from the Biden we have now. I think Trump is going to deal with a couple of problems here. Number one is the moderator bias. Like, Trump is just going to get railroaded by any moderator he's up against, so he has to then railroad them in return. And look, I actually don't think Biden is going to be the guy that comes out looking good in any of these encounters. But at the same time, I also think that in a lot of ways it doesn't matter, because the media will provide cover for Joe Biden, as they do time and time again. The media will have to choose, okay, maybe we don't like that he is senile and doesn't seem to know up or down or left or right or any of that, but, well, at least he's not Trump. And you're just going to have this never Trump dynamic in the media where they will overlook this. They will not report on a lot of it. They will not play the clips of the things that make him look bad. The only way you'll get them is on social media or on Fox News, because CNN, MSNBC, all of these networks, they are just not going to show them if they reveal Joe Biden to be really the tragedy that he is. And I actually find it quite upsetting. And, you know, I realize the allure and the appeal of circulating these clips, but it is genuinely elder abuse at this point. So, no, I'm not worried about Trump being underprepared for a debate about Joe Biden. I just think in a lot of cases, it fundamentally will not matter what happens. So this is a question from Fran Lavery. We're going back to the UK here. With an American tie-in, though, the opening statement at the court hearings with Ofcom posted by Naomi Wolf at her Substack this morning was as powerful an opening statement as I ever read. Did I hear Mark Stein mention that Naomi Wolf would not be able to defend herself here in this case, or did I misunderstand? Can you please explain this to me? All the very best to you, Andrew. Well, thank you very much, Fran. So I think, look, I don't want to pretend that I know the ins and outs of the legal rules and procedures here, but I think there are a couple of points that I would raise on this, which is that, number one, it was a bit of a fight for, as I recall, Mark himself to be able to fight this case, because the way that these things are traditionally dealt with is that the finding is not against the person. The finding is against the network. The finding is against GB News. And GB News's position on this was effectively just to roll over, accept what Ofcom was saying and doing, and think that they could make their way into the good books just by throwing Mark under the bus. And, you know, the People's Channel was more interested in being Ofcom's channel than anything else. And, of course, what then happens? Ofcom continues to go after GB News. They go after GB News. I forget the tally now of findings against them and investigations, and Neil Oliver's gotten it. The news division has gotten it. The politics division has gotten it. Basically, most of GB News has been targeted, it feels like, by Ofcom in some way. So this idea of appeasement, this idea of becoming just like the Neville Chamberlain of broadcasters against Ofcom, didn't do anything to win over the state Commissar. And, you know, I know Mark has told this story, and I've told it as well, because I was helping out on the show doing some contract work. And, you know, I was in some of these meetings where we were talking with the compliance officer of GB News, or whatever his title was. And this is the guy who's supposed to be GB News's representative against Ofcom. And I recall saying to Mark and his manager, Melissa, that anytime we spoke to him, it was abundantly clear that he was becoming, or had become, and was Ofcom's representative in GB News, rather than the other way around. He was deferential to Ofcom. Anytime there was an objection brought up by Mark or Melissa or me about how Ofcom was doing something, he would instead try to just pacify us by defending Ofcom to us. He would tell us all the reasons that Ofcom was, oh, so reasonable, and they're so fine, and yes, this is just entirely the way that things are supposed to work, and we were just supposed to go along with it. And that was the position that led to where we are now. And ideally, in any sort of adversarial situation, when you are faced with a complaint or an investigation, you say, okay, how do we put our side forward? How do we defend this? And it was so abundantly clear, even early on, that GB News was not interested in defending. They were interested in justifying what Ofcom was doing. And, you know, whether it was because they were true believers or they're just so oriented to capitulation, I don't particularly care, because the upshot was the same regardless. And so anyway, that's a lengthy way, Fran, of saying that even Mark being able to defend himself was a bit of a departure from this. And Naomi, she was a guest on the show, and the show was on the station. So she's even one further step removed from it, which is why she's an interested witness in the case. So, you know, she has, you know, her own perspective, and she did post that opening statement. I know she's also, she also spoke outside the courthouse and has had a great deal of support. And, you know, her view that she put forward was not just on defending what she said on Mark's show, but also speaking about free speech and the importance of it and a history of censorship. And I think anyone that didn't listen to that would be missing out on something that was very important to formulate an opinion on what went down here. Gregory Lawton, now this is the L-A-U-G-H spelling, not the L-A-W spelling, totally different Lawtons. Do you have any idea the likelihood of Pierre Poilievre becoming prime minister? Well, let me look up the latest polls here, just for those who are interested, and not that we do the horse race stuff with any regularity. So the latest projections as of June 9th that I've seen here show the Conservatives with 43% of the vote, which this is, you know, remember, basically a five-party system, and projected to have a supermajority in the House of Commons. So this is a projection that has them at, see if I can get the top line number here. I don't have the top line number on this poll, but it basically has them just blowing everyone else out of the water and having such a decisive majority that, like, it's impossible to ever imagine a scenario in which you beat that. So that's basically where the Conservatives are right now in the polls. So if the election were held today, the likelihood would basically be, you know, 99.999%. There's always that risk that something comes up, that something changes. Now, as we get nearer to the election, I think it's important to note that the Conservatives have squandered winnable elections before. The Conservatives that looked like were probably going to have a pretty good go of things in 2019, and then in the end, even with Justin Trudeau prancing around in blackface and photos of that, they lost. In 2021, it looked as well, pretty much like the Conservatives were going to win, and then they did not. Now, the exception for this theory that I think is incredibly important to point out here is that none of those elections had the Conservatives in this supermajority territory. They were all going to be close races. They were all going to be cases where the Conservatives only were elected with a plurality but not a majority, what we call a minority government. Whereas this is like, even if the Conservatives were to drop 10%, they're still going to be winning a majority government. That's the reality right now. So yes, the Conservatives have a history of squandering leads, but it's very difficult to imagine a scenario in this election in which that happens. And I will point out too, Poilievre's approach to politics is vastly different than his predecessors has been. And I should say, as a bit of an authority on this, I spent much of the last year writing a biography of Pierre Poilievre, which just came out about 2 weeks ago. I think it was May 28th. So effectively 2 weeks ago in a day. And this book has done tremendously well. It's on the bestsellers list. It's been there for the last couple of weeks. It has gotten all of the rave reviews of the media, even though it's about a conservative figure, because there's a fascination with him. And I was looking, not that I try to just, you know, be this narcissistic, but I was just plugging around at different bookstores, seeing how it was moving, because I knew how many, you know, were in stock. And I saw it's moving, even in urban centers in Toronto and Ottawa and Calgary. It's selling. People are buying it. And, you know, is it because they like him? Is it because they're curious about him? I mean, a sale's a sale. So in that sense, I don't really care. But there's a groundswell of support for him and the Conservatives right now. And the media's and the left's attempts to frame him in a certain way, to malign him, are simply not working. Lawrence Jarvik writes, why isn't the Ofcom case moot now that evidence of harm has been publicly released and compensation payments have been made? Officialdom doesn't like to admit wrongdoing. Officialdom doesn't do it at all. And, you know, remember when a lot of the harms of lockdown started to become more apparent, you had this term that started popping up, pandemic amnesty, where people that called for vicious, vicious, vicious restrictions on your liberty, segregation based on your vaccine status, all of this stuff, people that championed some of the most horrendous things we would see in a liberal democracy in this era, said, oh, whoops, mea culpa. Let's just all move on. Let's just all say, yeah, maybe you got some things wrong and I got some things wrong. You know, what? It all comes out in the wash. What does it matter? And then they do this. And it's like, well, hang on. What if I don't want to just forget about it? What if I can't just move on from it? And that's, I think, the problem here is that governments have wanted that amnesty as well. Governments have, whenever these have been challenged in court, which has happened a lot in Canada, and generally hasn't worked out too well because of, you know, judges being what they are. But when this has come up, the government says, well, it was the information available at the time. Well, at the time, we thought this, we felt this, we believed this. So that is where we are now. And why isn't the case moot? Look, I think you can debate the extent of harm. You can debate this. But the reality is the government of Canada, the government of the UK, the governments in Scandinavia, governments in various states in the United States, these are all countries that have in some way walked back parts of their vaccine rollout plans. In some way, maybe it's we just pull the AstraZeneca, maybe we change the age thresholds, but they've all in some form, even the most, you know, COVID zero oriented governments have all pulled back in some form. Now, the UK has done this more dramatically. So how the UK government is justifying this continued crusade against GB News and against Mark when it, by its own admission, has gotten key facts wrong is a level of brazenness. I played the clip earlier. I get that. But I want to play it again because I want you to hear the way they describe this and just how nonchalantly they are. And really, gaslighting, I think, explains very well this dynamic. This is that clip of Dame Melanie Dawes.
I was just wondering if I could ask you about whether you think Ofcom is being fair in enforcing its COVID misinformation policy against very legitimate discourse about COVID.
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean, to be honest.
Well, people that have spoken about vaccine injuries have received Ofcom complaints and investigations, and broadcast licenses are in jeopardy of people that talk about very real issues.
I just don't think that we've... I'm not sure. It's very hard to answer that question without a specific instance, but...
GB News is facing investigations.
Well, there are sometimes cases where we open up an investigation, but, you know, let's see how that goes. What we're absolutely clear about is that freedom of expression is incredibly important in the way that we deal with the broadcasting code, so people are absolutely entitled to express views. So we always abide by those principles whenever we're looking into anything.
So do you believe that discussing vaccine injury should be allowed?
Certainly, absolutely. Free and frank and open conversations are always good on any topic.
I know it's repetitive, but it's the way that they just dismiss any concern. Oh, well, yes, yeah, we welcome everything. But then the record does not support that. The record does not support it. And what I find so interesting here when you look at this is that, you know, governments are sucking and blowing at the same time. And the UK is a great example of this. The UK has a vaccine injury compensation scheme. Now, let me just say perfectly candidly, I think a lot of concerns about vaccine harms are overblown. I think a lot of people try to elevate things and put everything under the banner of being a vaccine injury in the same way that a lot of the COVID alarmists said that everything was COVID. And I think there are two sides of the same coin there. But I also concede that it's not overinflated if you are someone that dealt with a vaccine injury, if you are someone who lost a loved one to this. And there's a difference between people making a decision for themselves and accepting the risks, and people being forced into it because they need a vaccine to go to work. They need a vaccine to go to a cafe. They need a vaccine to travel. These people who had a choice taken away from them in a lot of ways. There's something very fundamentally different about these cases. And what Ofcom did, Ofcom, which is a broadcast regulator, it is not a public health office, decided to abdicate its authority to people who, by their own admission, were making it up as they went along. I mean, not that Anthony Fauci was running things in the UK, but I think he probably was in a way, in the sense that so many countries around the world were following his lead and the United States' lead on this. He said a couple of weeks back that, yeah, social distancing, and I was masking the other one, there were two things, but he said social distancing was something he kind of just made up. There was no evidence for it. He just sort of thought, okay, maybe this makes sense. And there was something else in that category as well. It might have been masking or some other restriction. Doesn't matter. The point is, Fauci now, in hindsight, is saying that all of this stuff that was given to us with such authority was just sort of written on the back of a napkin one day. Well, Ofcom was enforcing a speech code, enforcing censorship, imposing censorship on people based solely on what governments, what fallible governments were saying in the moment when, by their own admission, they've all said that they didn't have all the facts at the time and had to just roll with it. And I think that is quite shocking here. This is a message from Elisa Angel, who writes, when Christine Lagarde tells you she's in a quiet place so she doesn't have to answer your questions, and others who are office holders, quasi-office holders, or working on public policies ignore your questions, what do you think? Are the potential interviewees busy, tired, or hiding something? Why not broadcast their policies through every available outlet? So just as a bit of context there, I've now been to, how many times have I been to Davos? Is it three or four? I think it's three times. I went, in 2022, which was in the spring, and then I went in 2023 and most recently this year. And I'm not one of Klaus Schwab's invited elites. I've gone as a journalist. One time they accredited me and then they realized that was a terrible mistake and they had me just standing out in the cold again this past year. So your only option to interview the Davos elites is to catch them as they're coming and going, to catch them as they're going on their way in or out, walking around the promenade, and hopefully they can't scurry through security more quickly than, you know, my camera guy and I can get up to them and ask them a question, as happened with Dame Melanie Dawes. But this year, it was rather interesting. I saw Christine Lagarde, who's the head of the European Central Bank. She's one of the regulars on the Davos circuit. And I asked her, I can't even remember what my question was. I think it was about digital currency, which she had just said something along the lines of pushing. And the theme for Davos was rebuilding trust. That was so key, rebuilding trust. And when all of these people talk about a trust deficit, they don't look at themselves and say, oh, maybe we're squandering trust. They instead look and say, well, you know, it's the media, it's the far right, it's Putin, it's all of these people. And so I asked her along that vein, it was a very nice sort of just warm-up question, basically, about trust and digital currency and institutions and all of this, however I worded it. And she said, I'm in a quiet place right now, so I'm not doing any interviews. Then she kept walking. And I had, you know, joked at the time that I'll use that next time my, you know, wife asked me to do something. I'll just say, I'm in a quiet place right now. And I didn't like run up to her at the spa. I was like, you know, catching her as she was walking along the promenade in Davos. But there were plenty of other folks who, and I mean, credit to Dame Melanie Dawes. She stopped and spoke to me for a minute. I also spoke to Australia's chief internet censor, Julie Inman Grant. She stopped and spoke for a couple of minutes as well. But most of them will just put their heads down and keep walking. And, you know, I spoke, I forget his name, but he was the head of University College London. And I asked him about anti-Semitism. And, you know, he just had nothing to say on it at first. And then eventually he realized that maybe him walking away when I asked him to condemn anti-Semitism wouldn't look too well. So he stopped and spoke for a couple of moments at that time. But the theory that I have about Davos is that for the entirety of the World Economic Forum's existence, it's always been a safe space for the elites. It's very expensive to get there. It's very costly to stay there. And the reason I say that is because the World Economic Forum buys up pretty much every hotel in town and in the neighboring towns, and most of the Airbnbs as well. The ones that are left over are insanely expensive. You'll pay like, you know, $10,000 for a week at some of them and still have trouble getting in. And they do this deliberately because they don't want people there. They don't want protesters. They don't want watchdogs. They don't want activists. And they certainly don't want journalists who aren't part of their who aren't part of their chosen group. And what I found so interesting about these people is that when I started going in 2022, now admittedly that was in the spring, they really, really were not used to it. And it was, the weather was nice because this was the first post-COVID one. So they were all walking around freely. And then in January of 2023, they were a lot more bundled up, a lot more secluded. They were getting into cars instead of walking around. And part of that, I thought, okay, maybe it's just the weather. Maybe it's just colder weather, so they're, you know, making sure they're staying hidden. But this year, I noticed a huge decline in how accessible people were. Because it used to be, like I said, you know, CEO of Microsoft walking around and, you know, president of this country, prime minister of this country. And you still see a little bit of it, but not nearly as much as you did last year, and certainly not as much as 2 years ago. And one of the reasons for that is that I think they're finally realizing that people are going to call them out on it. And people like me are going to be out there waiting for them at the security gate in a way that wouldn't have happened a few years ago. So it's no longer this safe space. I think the shine of Davos has really faded a fair bit. It doesn't have the heads of government and heads of state like it used to. It doesn't have these massively important people like it used to. It still has some, and it still has a level of influence, but it's not... There's a fear and a trepidation now that eyes are on it. And I think it's really proof of the point that sunlight is the greatest disinfectant. So Christine Lagarde can be in a quiet place all she wants, but when people are seeing her walking away, seeing her not want to answer a very simple question, I think that undermines the whole thing here, that these people do not want to and do not see themselves as being accountable to ordinary folks. They see themselves as members of this technocracy that is better than you and I. And in the case of people like Lagarde, that we can't even really vote out. The notorious Mr. J writes, here's hoping Mark's health is improving. Best wishes to him as he goes into legal combat. Regarding America, is there any hope of its legal system not sliding into total corruption? We all know the travesty of justice that was Mark Stein's court case. As pointed out in last week's submission to the canceled Q&A session, Donald Trump's hopes may lie in the example of Lula da Silva. Just like in Brazil, he may do brief slammer time and then roar back into power. And as I wrote back then, hearing the words just like in Brazil should give all Americans pause. One should be open-minded on the possibility of lawfare assault as a universal sport. Take Hunter Biden's recent conviction. Should we take it on blind faith that no political bias was involved? No. Given today's atmosphere, that possibility should be ruled out. The pubs have been baying for Biden's blood for some time, so don't think it impossible that some might stoop to seedy lawfare. Think back to the overblown fiasco that was the Monica Lewinsky fair. I show you the times. Well, I imagine you've probably enraged a few people in your last couple of sentences there, but I think you're right in the sense that it's a race to the bottom. When people see the Democrats and the left use certain tactics, people on the right feel, okay, fine, we'll use them too. And in the end, we're not defending or upholding or protecting or fixing these institutions. We're all just, you know, contributing in our own way to the downward spiral of Western civilization. So take from that what you will. But I do think there is a slight difference in, well, I'll go back to, you know, 2 points here. The United States has always viewed itself as having institutions that are sacred. And all countries have this to their own degree. And in the U.S., the sacred institution for the right has always been the Constitution. And as you've heard Mark admonish you many, many times, if you're listening to this, don't wave your Constitution in my face. And I used to be a Constitution waver. I used to be one of these people because I saw it was generally effective. And I think that it was to some extent. I was probably a bit naive when I started exploring things like this in thinking that it was doing a bit more than it was, because you have institutions that are still corrupted at other levels. And, you know, the Constitution doesn't really matter if you have corrupt judges or activist judges who are tasked with interpreting it and who say is binding. And, you know, in Canada, you know, we have a Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is effectively our Bill of Rights. And the first section of the charter effectively nullifies the rest of it, because it says, yeah, you know, we've listed all these fundamental freedoms like free speech and religious freedom and all of that, but all of these things are subjected to, quote, reasonable limits, unquote. Which means in Canada, court battles are not won or lost on constitutional matters by a judge adjudicating, did it violate your constitutional rights or not? They decide that at first, and then we'll say, oh yes, this did violate your constitutional rights, but the government was justified. And then they come up with some ham-fisted rationale for why the justification was actually reasonable and why, yes, it compromises your free speech, but the government had a good reason to do it. So all of this is really coming in a context in which this is not new. And I mean, the U.S., I said earlier, has a better track record on free speech because of the First Amendment. This is true. At the end of the day, if I'm going to be facing some sort of a censorship law, I'd rather be doing it in the US than Canada. I'd rather be doing it in Canada than in the UK. But we're talking about a narrowing of that optimism. We're talking about a narrowing of that where it's you don't have as marginally large an advantage in the US compared to these other countries as you did even a few years ago. And I don't think it's something that can be saved right now. And you know, when you look, I mean, I'm a foreigner. I'm more of a foreigner than Mark because I've never lived in the United States. So I can't even figure out which court is responsible for what when you have, you know, the Second Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, the, you know, Seventh Circuit. I mean, it basically just sounds like you're going through Dante's stages of hell, which I think pretty much describes what anyone who's been in the U.S. legal system has done. Matt from upstate New York writes, on a recent trip to Ireland, I had a number of discussions with friends there about Ireland's stance on Israel and Gaza. They were not happy with their country's stance on the Middle East, but they were in a minority. While there, Ireland, along with Spain and Norway, recognized the so-called Palestinian state. My friends were horrified. Any thoughts in the optics of Ireland, which stayed neutral in World War II, taking the side of Israel's enemy in the current conflict? So as it happened, two rather interesting coincidences here. When this happened, when Ireland, Spain, and Norway came out with their declaration, I was in Taiwan, and I was there with a group of journalists that I had not met before, and there was an Israeli journalist there who, you know, got pulled away from our sessions with Taiwanese officials because he had to go and file something on this. And, you know, it was interesting how... I mean, there were a couple of people that were saying, well, you know, if Ireland is going to recognize Palestine and Spain and Norway are going to recognize Palestine, hey, why aren't they recognizing Taiwan? And, you know, not to equate the Palestinian cause with the Taiwanese cause, because they're very, very, very different. But if we're just in the business of, you know, recognizing new states, why not start with Taiwan was sort of the question that was raised, which I found to be compelling enough. Except, obviously, it doesn't apply because these countries are playing into this oppressor-oppressed narrative, where if you believe in a two-state solution, which I have always done, the key there is that it has to be a negotiated two-state solution. You have to get the Palestinians and the Israelis to agree on the terms of what those two states will be. And the reality is, anytime this has come up, it's fallen apart because you get a group that cannot agree to lay down its arms. And by the way, even the idea of what Palestine is not clearly delineated. Who is the government of the Palestinian state that Ireland recognizes? Is it Hamas or is it Fatah? Is it the terrorists who are murdering Israelis and are kidnapping them and holding some hostage still? Or is it Mahmoud Abbas, who's in what, like the 12th year of his 4-year term right now? And, you know, admittedly, if there were to be an election, Hamas would probably win in the Palestinian Authority too. So the problem here is that you have all of these countries that are doing this woke virtue signaling, where they just check a box because they're dealing with a rising protest in their own country and trying to show that they're woke enough without thinking of the ramifications of it. And Ireland and Norway have in particular just become these tremendously internationalist countries that are, you know, not really concerned about their own national issues or national sovereignty, but they love to do the UN's bidding, which is why they're always so aggressively seeking, you know, seats on the Security Council and whatnot. It's why they're fielding Norway in particular so much in the way of peacekeepers. They're not interested in dealing with the realist interpretation of the facts of what's happening in the Middle East. And like I said, it was, you know, fascinating to just read about this when I was in Taiwan and seeing the double standard in the way they deal with who is deserving of sovereignty and recognition and who isn't. KD writes, is your book about Pierre Polyev getting him attention, or is he bringing attention to the book? Which came first, the chicken or the egg? I would love to claim credit for my book contributing to Pierre Polyev's name recognition, but I think it's fair to say that his popularity has helped the book more than the other way around. Now, that being said, I think what's in the book, which was, you know, written in a journalistic way, not a promotional way, is probably, I mean, look, people are going to take from it different things, but I think what's in the book will help people reach a a more firm position on who he is and what he's about and whatnot. I think when he really started to get a lot more attention was when he did that apple bit a few months back, where he was in an apple orchard in British Columbia in the Okanagan region, and there was this like horrendously hackish left-wing journalist that was asking him about, oh, you know, being a populist and taking a page out of Trump's playbook and this and that, but couldn't defend, like couldn't back up any question. He'd say, oh, your populist rhetoric, and Paulia would be like, give me an example. He'd be like, oh, you say, like, you know, left wing. Like, he couldn't say anything. And Poilievre is just nonchalantly, you know, standing there munching on an apple, swatting this guy's questions away. And there was a reason my publisher put that transcript, which I included in the book in full, on the back cover of the book, because it's a polarizing snippet, but it shows, you know, his greatest asset and the greatest source of criticism, which is just the way he engages with people being unlike everyone else up until this point. Ken in WA. Now, I don't know if that's Ken in Western Australia or Ken in Washington or Ken in West Afghanistan. Who knows? He says, Andrew, the wig you put on for the Stein Show may well have been the one I sent him shortly after the lawsuit was filed by Michael Mann. It was part of a costume that included a robe. I was inspired by watching Rumpole of the Bailey. I always wondered what he did with it. So that may be the case that that still exists, Ken, but I can actually tell you this wig did not come from there because I had to get fitted for it from a costumer in Montreal. So I did not wear your barrister's wig, but I'm sure Mark holds it as a prized possession because he's always been quite fond about the old traditional barrister wigs. In fact, I'm amazed Mark wasn't wearing a barrister's gown when he was sitting in the Washington, D.C. courtroom for the Michael Mann trial. Kenneth writes, with the focus on Trump and Gaza and other events, Klaus Schwab and the WEF seem to be laying low. Any updates on what might be coming out of Davos? Well, it's early yet, Kenneth. We are still about 6 months away from the next annual meeting, and I've already booked my Airbnb the next town over so that I can go and enjoy as much as possible, and maybe Christine Lagarde will be out of her quiet period next year, in which I should actually just have that clip on my phone in case I see her and she tries the line again. I said, hang on, how long is that? You're in like the longest meditative trance in the history of, you know, Zen and Buddhism or whatever. But the one thing that I find interesting is that even if you set aside, you know, whatever dangerous policy prescriptions you believe that the Davos set is pushing, you know, basically trying to send us back into the Stone Age by assaulting energy, for example, and really moving beyond property and shareholder ownership of companies and all of this. You know, even if you set aside all of that and just look at them as an organization, they don't really have much to show for their grandiose plans, because the stated pitch of Klaus Schwab and company has always been that by bringing people together, we can solve the world's problems. And no one is looking at the world right now and saying that things have improved in recent years. People forget that Putin was one of the keynote speakers. One of the keynote speakers the year before Russia invaded Ukraine. So this idea of the global collaboration of the public and private sectors did not prevent a European ground war. Xi Jinping was a keynote speaker, I believe, that same year. That has not stopped China from unleashing economic harm and a number of other harms on countries around the world. So all of these people that have a seat at the table in Davos tend to just walk all over so many leaders. And Klaus Schwab is continuing to tell people that he's the guy, that he's the guy that should be at the head of the table. And remember, no one elects him. The World Economic Forum has no official standing. Whatever you think of the United Nations, at least it has an official standing in a way. Secretary General Antonio Guterres, in an indirect way, has a democratic mandate because he's elected by countries who are elected by people. And I mean, look, I'm not defending the UN here, but I'm saying it has an official status. The World Economic Forum is an organization. It is a think tank that somehow has convinced the world that it needs to be the one holding the multilateral sessions because they can hold them there away from the prying eyes of the press and public without the accountability that comes along with a democratic mandate. So Whatever comes next, it won't be good. We have time for one more question here. Jeff says, I see some of the mainstream media finally reluctantly covered Mark's suit against Ofcom, but that reluctance is incredibly frustrating. This should be a major story throughout the Anglosphere. Why do you think they ignored it for so long? I think because they were part of the problem. Remember that a lot of these media outlets, especially when it comes to television stations, were and are under the regulatory authority of Ofcom itself. So they decided that they were going to uphold the regime. They were going to go along with the rules. And I think a lot of them, certainly some, like The Telegraph, has started writing about things that Mark was talking about years ago, as though it's new now. And I've always been one of these, you know, better late to the party than never sorts of people, but I realize that it also rings hollow for a lot of folks when the media is just pretending that they did not play a part in the big shut-up on some issues a few years ago, the harms of lockdowns, the inherent wrong of vaccine mandates, to name a couple of things, and now they're these Johnny-come-latelys to the party. And look, I think the problem is when you cover Mark's case, they also have to look in the mirror at their own role in this and their own role in not challenging authority themselves, which is what they were supposed to do. So that's my theory in a nutshell there. We will have to end things there. My thanks to all of you for tuning in. If you like talking to people that view the world a little bit more like you do, you should consider coming out on the Mark Stein Cruise. Now, the Mark Stein Cruise, I have been on every one of them. It is always great fun. The next one is going to be April 6th to 13th on Celebrities MS Celebrity Apex. And there are some great guests that are set to be announced. And the itinerary, by the way, on this one looks absolutely beautiful. I have not been to many of these places. It starts in Barcelona, goes to Lisbon, stops in Porto, and goes to La Coruña, Spain, and ends up in Southampton. So it's not like the Titanic. This one ends in Southampton rather than starting there. But it's going to be a fantastic experience. News to come on that. And you can get all the details at www.markstinecruise.com. And just to put a shameless plug in for my own work, my book, Pierre Poilievre, A Political Life, is out. And it's available in Canada, the US. I think it's on Amazon UK as well. If not, there are some books en route. So if you're one of the, you know, three Brits that is interested in Pierre Poilievre, you can get one of those three copies any day now. But thank you so much. We will talk to you soon, everyone. Have a wonderful rest of the week.
Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.